Welcome to Moving the Needle, casual conversations about ways, big and small, to impact student learning. Brought to you by the Faculty Center for Teaching and Learning at the University of Maryland, Baltimore. I'm Erin Hager. Let's move the needle.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Moving the Needle. We're in for a treat today. My guest is the 2024 University of Maryland Founders Week Educator of the Year, Dr. Adam Puget. Dr. Puget is a professor and vice chair of the Department of Anatomy and Neurobiology in the School of Medicine, where he teaches gross anatomy, histology, and embryology. He helped transform the structure of the two-year anatomy course for the School of Medicine's Renaissance curriculum. And for those of you who aren't familiar with this massive student-centered change brought about by the Renaissance curriculum, you can listen to our interview with the head of that project, Dr. Devang Patel, Episode 6. Specifically, Dr. Puget introduced several innovations to this curriculum, including a new way to coordinate the use of anatomic donors, so that both first and second-year students can benefit from the same donation, while also engaging in the process of a clinical handoff between the two groups of students, much like the way they will do when they're practicing clinically. There are a great many insights and perspectives explored in our conversation today, but what struck me most about Dr. Puget was his intentionality. As you hear him describe his teaching, you just can't help but be impressed with the thoughtfulness and consideration he brings to his interactions with students. Every decision he makes and approach he takes is designed to support and challenge the students on their educational journey. We talk about ways he ensures students feel included in the learning process and safe while making mistakes. No matter what discipline you're teaching, there is much to be learned from this point of view. We know you will enjoy this discussion. Dr. Puget, welcome to Moving the Needle.
It's a pleasure. Glad to be here.
Why don't we begin by having you tell us a bit about your path to education? How did you become a medical educator, and what is the context of your teaching now?
So I'd actually argue that I never stopped being an educator. All the way back to being a fellow student, peer education is such a good, strong component. I always enjoyed peer education. And I think that that passion for helping others led from being a student to into my PhD work, into my postdoctoral work, into being a faculty member. There was always a component of helping others present. And so I think it was sort of a natural evolution when my immediate predecessor, Larry Anderson, passed away unexpectedly, for me to volunteer to step into the role of leading the anatomic education program for the campus, and primarily the medical school, but it extends across much of the campus as well in the allied health programs. And so I think it was just a natural evolution of a long-standing interest and desire to help others that led me to where I am now.
That's wonderful. Tell me a little bit about what peer education meant to you as when you were a student and what it means to you now.
Peer education was very different back when I was a student in the 80s, which is dating me terribly, I'm sure. Because peer education then was simply a couple of friends talking about a problem or a lecture. There was nothing formalized. There was nothing structured. It was just you knew to go to Adam to ask about genetics, and you'd go over to Mary to ask about the statistical analysis of things, and you knew who to talk to when you were having trouble. That was peer learning of the time. Now we consider peer learning in a much more rigorous manner because it's been shown to be so effective. And so I'd say in the modern context, we look at peer learning as something that we design into a curriculum, not something that we expect the students to evolve into spontaneously. And I would argue that it's probably better for us to structure a peer learning because that captures everybody. In the days when I was a student, if you didn't know people, you got left out of the peer learning community.
Even though you could have had wonderful things to contribute and wonderful perspectives to share, you may not have just been invited into those conversations by accident.
Yes, absolutely. You just never ran into these people because you had a class of 300 students in basic bio. You only really ever interacted with 30 or 40 of them. And so you would never get that. And so by structuring this into the curriculum through our Renaissance curriculum in the medical school, that assigns students to a small group. And then in a large teaching room, the small groups break out to solve a particular problem. and they may have 8 minutes to go through this case and achieve a consensus decision amongst the five or so students at that table. Then the preceptor will reconvene and call upon different groups to explain their reasoning or take a counterpoint from group two to something that group one came up with and see when the room achieves a consensus. And so that structures a peer learning in a cyclical manner with large group learning components. And that tends to be the modern approach to case-based and team-based learning. And so the medical school has embraced that fully within our resonance curriculum. And a mainstay of what I do is anatomic education, which is in the laboratory setting, the gross anatomy lab. And that is intrinsically a peer-based learning environment because there'll be a team of four students working with a donor. And they have a series of tasks to achieve. And so they have to coordinate and understand the instructions and work with each other to achieve those outcomes. So even all the way back 200 years ago to the founding of UMB, through the medical school, there has always been that peer-based component in anatomy. It just predates our understanding of how effective peer-based learning is.
How do you prepare students for that kind of interaction with each other?
We do a few practice sessions, particularly in the introduction to medicine, and the first sessions are designed to get them used to the environment. But I would argue that many of our students are more familiar with peer-based learning than our faculty are, because they are coming from an undergraduate environment which is advancing in leaps and bounds in the integration of these modern learning paradigms. And some of our faculty who have been around longer than others may not be quite so conversant with those modern theories.
What might you say to a reluctant faculty member who is trying a team-based learning, a case-based learning, a peer approach for the first time?
Well, the easiest way is to have them come along to a session that you know is going to run smoothly and well so that they can see it in operation. Because I can describe how to do it till the cows come home, and that won't come across. Whereas I think that if they participate in a peer-based type session, they will see how it flows, how it operates, and be able to adapt and take that to their own classroom structures. And so I think, like with any learning, doing is more effective than hearing.
Right. Where do you think the reluctance comes from to adapt some of these newer approaches?
To take up a new approach does require you to restructure teaching materials, and that is a considerable time investment. And we are all pressured for time. Certainly in the medical school, none of us are professional educators. None of us do education even as our primary task. We are researchers, clinicians. We have other duties and responsibilities. And we do education because it's a passion most of the time. And so there is a reluctance to adopt a changed approach sometimes because there is a workload to it. But I would say very few people exhibit that much reluctance once they've seen the efficacy and the operation of it. So I would say that most faculty embrace change and embrace a little bit of a challenge.
I've noticed the same thing in my work. And one of the things that I've noticed is when faculty members feel the difference in the energy of a classroom that is structured in such a way that the students are grappling with new ideas and practicing new concepts in real time in a way that the faculty member can see, as opposed to them going back to their apartments, their own private settings, and grappling with it on their own. There's a mutually reinforcing energy that tends to happen. Have you experienced that?
Oh, absolutely. I would say that humans in general are social creatures. We know that from studies going back as far as anyone wants to measure. And education is just as social. The discussion, the give and take of ideas, the helping someone reach an epiphany, all of those are elements that any educator thrives upon. Going back to Socrates, in those early Greek methods of teaching, that had a give and take of discussion as well. And so I think every educator thrives in that environment. And once somebody sees that this is an environment which enhances that component, they jump into it wholeheartedly.
One thing that I've also noticed that creates a shift in that energy is the sharing of stories in an educational setting. And I'm wondering if you have any stories from your teaching that demonstrate an evolution in your change of teaching, or, you know, a moment in time where a teaching aha moment happened for you based on what was going on with a student.
I'm not sure that I've experienced a sea change epiphany in that structure. It's more been a slow evolution of techniques over decades than it has been a radical shift. There are always many, many moments, many small individual moments where you adapt your teaching style to the student and you recognize what the student needs and change the style accordingly. Those moments are a educator's bread and butter. And I would say that all of the great educators on our campus have those types of moments. For me, at least, I don't think there was a single epiphany moment that made me change style radically. It was an evolution of process more than a sea change.
If you were going to point out some landmarks of that evolution, where might you say you began and what slowly changed over time?
Well, probably the biggest change to my education is when I took over as the anatomy lead for the medical school. Because until somebody has done that, they don't recognize the complexity of that task. Teaching the anatomy program is probably the most logistically complicated educational program on the campus because you're dealing with surgical instrumentation, donors, safety of a laboratory environment, effectiveness of teaching, the cross-connection of anatomy being learnt with the clinical undertaking, the management of a dozen faculty members and up to 200 learners in the environment. All of that, I never appreciated the complexity of it until I'd actually done it. As epiphanies go, that's probably one of the more eye-opening moments, is that curriculum design and management is radically different than being an instructor. And we have many, many great instructors and we have many, many great curriculum developers. And helping people to go from being a great instructor to being a curricular leader is also a fantastically useful process and something that as a campus we should support.
Speaking of that anatomy lab, in addition to the innovations you have brought with the curriculum, with approaches like team-based learning, case-based learning, you have also brought other types of innovations to that space. Can you talk a little bit about what you've done and what impact it's had?
So this space operates across three of the schools in UMB. So we support medical school, dental school, graduate school, and the various programs through the same space. And so we needed a space that would be modern, flexible, and a showcase for all of those schools. And what we had was a 1970s design and facility, which needed an upgrade. And this is only the fifth iteration of anatomy laboratory teaching in the campus since its founding. The first was Davidge Hall itself. The second was Gray Hall behind Davidge. The third was the old Bressler building up on Green Street. And then the new Bressler building, which is now 50 years old. So I think we can drop new out of the name. And the new renovation of that space that we just undertook, making the fifth iteration. And so part of it was to make the anatomy environment as close to the practicing environment for the learner as it could be. So we wanted to look like an operating room. We wanted to have lighting of that nature. We wanted to have decor and facilities that match the surgical environment because that's where our learners are going to be practicing. And so if we can make the environment closer to the environment in which they have to practice, then the practice environment becomes less intimidating and their effectiveness in that environment is improved. So it's not just the implementation of team-based learning, it's to provide a patient-centric, career-centric type structure to the space that they can learn to practice in.
Yes, as you're talking, I'm thinking about the concept of cognitive load in a student. And when so much is new all at once, our ability to, you know, to process all of that information is more challenging. And it sounds like what you're doing in creating a space that looks like where they will be going to practice is when they transition, some of that cognitive load will be reduced because they are in an environment that looks and feels similar to the environment in which they learned.
Absolutely. I'm a firm believer in cognitive load and understanding that. In fact, I've had Department of Defense grants for the last 9 years studying educational approaches to improving performance. And part of that involves assessment of cognitive load and mechanisms by which there can be a cognitive offloading of responsibility under those research paradigms to try to examine this process. And I agree wholeheartedly that in clinical practice, it's almost certainly taking place. And having the learning environment in the anatomy labs look like a modern operating room type environment as much as we can in a shared space, that will reduce the load to the students in that next step.
You know, it also strikes me too, in a setting like this, you know, perhaps working with a donor for the first time, first few times, the stress of medical school, the stress of the volume of information, thinking about the stressors, the emotional state of students in this environment, seems that it would be very important. And you've been quoted as saying that your intention is to create a safe fail for students in order to reduce some of that stress and to improve learning. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that and how it shows up?
Absolutely, because I think that all of us should be comfortable with failing because we learn the most from failing. But to be willing to fail takes a certain bravery. And it takes a certain understanding that when you fail somebody else, that they're okay with that. And so I think that when an instructor asks a student a question, you want an environment where the student feels comfortable in volunteering an answer, even if they're very unsure of what their answer is, because they know whether they get the answer correct or incorrect, they will get support from the instructor. They will get positive reinforcement of the correct answer, even if they get it wrong, and that there will be nothing judgmental in it. And so that safe failing, as I was quoted in talking about, is really an environment where I want the students to feel completely safe in volunteering an answer, knowing that they won't have somebody judging them. And that provides a much lower emotional load and concern load to the students to have that environment. And so I try to portray that myself, and I make sure that my instructors understand that this is the concept that we have in this instructional setting.
If you were going to describe those behaviors an instructor could take to create that safe space for failing, what does it look like in practice?
So in practice, it can be just as simple as making eye contact and smiling, and rather than simply frowning and saying, "Oh, that's wrong," you would say, "Well, it's probably not quite the way it is. Let's explore through the problem." Try to lead the student to the answer rather than just give them an answer. Say, "You're wrong. Here's the answer." Is say, "Are you really sure that's correct? Could it be this? Have you considered X, Y, or Z?" And try to lead the student to reaching the correct answer rather than trying to be immediately judgmental and give them the answer. I think that leading the horse to water is a better educational process than simply providing it out front. And I believe that it also creates a safer, less judgmental environment if the student knows they're going to be directed to finding the answer rather than simply told you are wrong by some gruff individual.
Yeah, as you're talking, I can think of experiences I've had as a student where as I'm remembering them, I can still feel the flush in my cheeks and my heart rate going up when I realized that I had answered something incorrectly. But that thought of being taken from that moment through a secondary process to help at least get closer to the right answer feels like that would have created a sense of recovery from that kind of initial emotional reaction.
Absolutely. And that sense of recovery that can be generated by that leading through a multi-step process to the correct answer, that in and of itself diminishes the emotional stress of being wrong the next time. And so after you run through a few of those processes, people become much more comfortable volunteering the wrong answer. And there are other little strategies, like telling students that it's okay to get a consultation, because we are in an allied health profession where you need to consult with professionals from multiple disciplines. And so telling students you can dial a friend, so to speak, when asked a question is perfectly fine as well, because it's partly a team-based answering, not just an individual-based answering.
And when you think about the implication of that in practice, I want my doctor to ask a nurse who's seen a similar patient, for their thoughts. I want my doctor to reach out to a specialist. I want as many brains involved in my healthcare as is appropriate. And so that not only are you impacting that for the students, but for their practice lives as well.
And I also want them to feel safe in admitting that they got a diagnosis wrong, because quite often with a patient, you lack enough information to achieve the final diagnosis, but you have to start taking action early. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that action will be going down an incorrect pathway. And as more information comes on, you can redirect. And I'd like to instill an element where nobody needs to be embarrassed by having got their initial diagnosis needing refinement. And I think that if we can alleviate some of that embarrassment in the educational process, it may make people more willing to accept when they're wrong down the road. I can't tell you the number of times society has got themselves in problems because individuals, leaders, etc., can't admit when they're wrong. And so having a way that you can safely fail would be important in many careers, not just in medicine.
And I can tell that that way of thinking is so natural to you because the phrase that you used, your initial diagnosis needed refinement, is such a inclusive and gentle way of letting people know that this is not wrong, wasn't a mistake. It just now we've got more information and it needs refining.
Yes, that in and of itself is a vocal pattern to lead somebody into a safe fail environment by saying that their diagnosis needs refinement, not saying this is wrong. And all those sort of word choices are an important component in reinforcement for students and helping them to grow into the spectacular people that they are and can be.
I feel like I can get a sense of this just from our brief conversation already, but how would you label the values that you bring to your teaching?
So I think openness and inclusiveness are super important because you need to be able to work with people, have them trust you to be asked questions, have them trust that you've generated a curricular process that will result in them becoming awesome. And part of that is all the way down to them just being able to talk to you, your trust component. So as with many professions, that openness and trust and approachability become core components of good educators, I think. And of course, there is the other logical ones of being organized, consistent, diligent, on time, all of those other components which feed into any educational program. But ultimately, it comes down to my trusting that the students will do the work and learn, and they're trusting that I've designed a program that will grow them as an individual and as a learner.
Yeah, that absolutely comes through in our conversation. And I can only think what a gift it would be to know that. I used in another podcast the analogy of swinging from a trapeze with a safety net underneath it. You know, the courage to reach out and reach for that bar that's coming at you when you're 50 feet in the air is a lot easier when you know that there is this protection built in to the whole experience.
I agree. And I think the role of the great educators we have on campus are to be that safety net and to catch that student, which has happened to me literally before when a student has passed out and I've had to catch them. But I'm hoping that it's more metaphorically catching them than literally capturing them for most of the educational program on the campus.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I wonder, when you think back, you know, you describe yourself as not only a lifelong learner, but a lifelong educator. But if you were to go back in time, what would you say to yourself, looking from your perspective now about your path as an educator? Is there any advice you would give yourself, any encouragement?
Probably it's don't care about the next exam, because everybody gets hung up with what is the next step. And they don't see the forest for the trees. They're hung up with the next exam. And I'd like to tell myself that the next exam doesn't really matter. You're in this for the long haul. It's the entire journey, not the individual steps, that matter. But it's very hard when you're taking those steps not to be focused on the next step. And I hope that our students at least get a feel that we are helping them on a journey, not helping them take individual steps.
When you're thinking about the journey that our faculty are on, and the incredible time pressures, the incredible demands, the disparate skills that come in, as you mentioned, organizing a curriculum, organizing the logistics of a shared space, engaging with the students, creating that personal rapport, keeping up with your own knowledge of the literature, everything that goes into that. How do you think that an institution can best support its faculty members on their journey to become the best professionals they can be?
I think a huge component of that comes down to making sure that they have the resources they need, just at the ground level, that we're not reinventing the wheel by each person having to buy their own software, or that there is expertise in the nuts and bolts of doing this. But far more important, that foundational component of infrastructure, which is clearly an institutional responsibility. I think it's to foster a community, because people learn to be good course directors by working with good course directors. And so having a peer learning environment at the faculty level and a peer learning environment at the curricular leadership level is just as important as having a peer learning environment for the student level. And so I think fostering that ability for our great educators to be able to work with the next generation of great faculty educators. As we were saying just before we started this interview, I look forward to the days where a former student becomes my boss, because I want to be surpassed by the next generation and I want them to become better than we were.
I think that if this were a recipe, the ingredients are right there on the table in front of you from your perspective and the values that you bring to this work and the openness and transparency that just comes through from our conversation. I thank you for your time today, but most importantly, just thank you for the contributions that you are making toward that next generation of medical educators. It has been so wonderful to talk with you.
It has been a pleasure to talk with you. And whilst I'm just one faculty member taking this journey, UMB is filled with faculty members taking this journey. And I may have won this award this year, but it's out of hundreds of people who are equally qualified and equally committed to making the educational program on UMB excellent.
I couldn't agree more. I have never felt so lucky to be surrounded by an incredible community of passionate educators. Congratulations again on this wonderful, well-deserved award.
Thank you for joining us today on Moving the Needle. Visit us at umaryland.edu/FCTL to hear additional episodes, leave us feedback, or suggest future topics. We'd love to hear from you.